From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The last so-called presidential debate is over. Clinton refuses to respond to Dole's attacks on ethics.
When you're the president of the United States, you have a public trust. You have to keep that public trust, as George Washington, as Abraham Lincoln did. And I think now that trust is being violated. It seems to me we ought to face up to it. The president ought to say tonight that he's not going to pardon anybody he was involved in business with who might implicate him later on.
I don't want to respond in kind to all these things. I could answer a lot of these things tit for tat, but I hope we can talk about what we're going to do in the future. No attack ever created a job or educated a child or helped a family make ends meet. No insult ever cleaned up a toxic waste dump or helped an elderly person. Now, for 4 years, that's what I worked on. If you give me 4 years more, I'll work on it some more.
The Lost Gospel of the Earth. Author, legislator Tom Hayden calls for renewing nature, spirit, and politics.
There's a gap between spirituality and politics, and the answer is not to widen the gap by considering spirituality a retreat into some exploratory inside journey, while politics is where you, you know, fight over interests and power and so on. I think some blending is in order, and that's different than a church-state fusion. This is merely giving what Vaclav Havel would call giving some kind of metaphysical anchor to your political work.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman with our national affairs correspondent, Larry Bensky. Last night, President Clinton and Bob Dole held their final, what's being touted as a debate before the November election. Larry, I would call it supremely choreographed, glorified soundbites, the time of those soundbites chosen by the candidates themselves. They settled on 90-second and 60-second soundbites that they would be giving throughout the night, which certainly does benefit both of them, since they don't want to particularly go into their records, just repeat what is we see repeated constantly in ads.
Yeah, but there was one element that they couldn't control totally last night, Amy, and that was the fact that this involved real citizens who did seem to have been chosen at random and were called on seemingly at random out of the audience. And it was interesting to note that the questions, as always happens in these town hall formats from real people, are very different from the type of questions you get from real journalists. They don't focus on process. They don't focus on personality. They focus on matters of principle and matters of policy.
I think that's true, although it is important to point out that these registered voters were chosen by the Gallup organization hired by the Commission on Presidential Debates. And the only requirement, I guess they said, is that they weren't particularly, that they wouldn't be fiercely pro-Clinton or pro-Dole, which means they also wouldn't be anti either of them, which means you're not going to get any strong people who are voting for someone else, for a third-party candidate, though there was a question asked about third-party candidates. Why don't we start, actually, with the way they started? It was the response to the first question about character, and this is what Dole and Clinton had to say.
There's no doubt about it that many American people have lost their faith in government. They see scandals almost on a daily basis. They see ethical problems in the White House today. They see 900 FBI files, private person being gathered up by somebody in the White House. Nobody knows who hired this man. So there's a great deal of cynicism out there. I think we have a real obligation. Obviously, public officials. I'm no longer a public official. I left public life on June the 11th of this year. But it is very important. Young people are looking to us. They're looking to us for leadership. They're watching what we do, what we say, what we promise, and what we finally deliver. And I would think, it seems to me, that there are opportunities here. When I'm president of the United States, I will keep my word. My word is my bond.
President?
One of the reasons that I ran for president, Sandy, is because not just children, a lot of grown-ups felt that way. And if you remember, 4 years ago, we had not only rising unemployment, but a lot of rising cynicism. I had never worked in Washington as an elected official. It seemed to me that most of the arguments were partisan, Republican, Democrat, left, right, liberal, conservative. That's why I said tonight I'm for opportunity, responsibility, and community. And we've gotten some real progress in the last 4 years. I've also done everything I could at every moment of division in this country.
President Clinton was very careful last night not to address any of the attacks on ethics.
Yeah, Amy, and it's interesting, you know, all the books that have been written, and there have been more than a dozen, the inside stories of Bill Clinton and his administration always stress the fact that the man has a terrible temper. And you could see him visibly last night restraining himself when he was attacked, sort of taking a deep breath, clenching his jaw, and then going right back to policy issues, not rising to the bait of trying to get into a fight with Bob Dole. Bob Dole at one point even broke through the debate format and said something that's not true, or tried to make a comment about something totally out of order. And Clinton didn't get into that either. All of the polls of the public show that people don't want a shouting and slanging character assassination match between the two candidates. And if anybody was going to take that role last night, it was Bob Dole. But it didn't really spark off the kind of thing that I think Dole wanted.
You know, I do think it's important to point out that the way the media always characterizes, you know, the character assassination is, in fact, I think, important to point out that we have to discuss issues, and that Clinton wants to make this an issue of character assassination because he doesn't want to address the issues. He attacks it by saying this is negativity. I mean, I watch Bush do it. I watch Reagan do it. When any real charges were held against them, they talk about negativity as opposed to dealing with the very real issues of, for example, the FBI files, the 900 FBI files of former White House employees, dealing with a number of other issues, campaign contributions, et cetera, although Dole is not exactly one to hurl these charges. Another question asked Larry was about tobacco.
Senator Dole, Oscar Delgado.
Oscar?
Ex-smoker for 30 years. About 30 years ago, I was a pack plus a day man, okay? You mentioned a statement you said some time ago that you didn't think nicotine was addictive. Would you care to, are you still hold to that statement, or do you wish to recant or explain yourself?
Oh, that's very easy. My record going back to 1965 in the Congress, the first vote we had was whether or not you should put a little notice on cigarettes. They may be dangerous. I voted for everything since that time. In fact, 1992, we had a bill come before us that all the states had to comply or they're going to lose certain money. We sent it to the Clinton administration for implementation. They waited 3.5 years. And during that period, about 3,000 young kids every day started smoking. So you add it up, that's about 3 million. Not until, again, 1996. I don't want anybody to smoke. My brother probably died partly because of cigarettes. I was asked a technical question. Are they addictive? Maybe they probably are addictive. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. You shouldn't smoke. You ought to be glad you quit, Oscar. 30 years? Yeah. And it seems to me that what we need to do is to talk about not only tobacco, but drugs. Because drug use between 12 and 17 years old has doubled in this administration the last 44 months. Marijuana use is up 141%. Cocaine use up 160%. They're your kids. It's all happened in this administration because they cut funding and they cut interdiction. When I'm president of the United States, we're going to use the National Guard and whatever sources we need to stop some of the drugs coming into America. If you stop the drugs, nobody's going to use the drugs. So don't smoke, don't drink, don't use drugs. Just don't do it.
Oscar, the question of what the federal government should do to limit the access of tobacco to young people is one of the biggest differences between Senator Dole and me. We did propose a regulation 6 months after I became president. Under the law he mentioned, it simply says all these states have made it illegal for kids to smoke. Now they have to try harder if they want to keep getting federal funds. Then we took comments, as we always do, and there were tens of thousands of comments about how we ought to do it. That's what drug it out. Meanwhile, we started, also in 93, to look into whether cigarettes were addictive enough for the Federal Food and Drug Administration to ban the ability of cigarette companies to advertise, market, and distribute tobacco products to our kids. No president had ever taken on the tobacco lobby before. I did. Senator Dole opposed me. He went down and made a speech to people who were on his side. saying that I did the wrong thing. I think I did the right thing.
Yes, the issue of tobacco was a question I think Bob Dole expected, although he's never been able to handle very well. One of the things he has promised that if elected, he will fire FDA Commissioner David Kessler, who is tobacco's number one enemy. And of course, he is surrounded by political operatives, and some of his largest contributions come from tobacco lobbies. His chief pollster, his former chief of staff, works with the law firm for the tobacco industry, as well as his convention manager, closely tied to the tobacco industry. So on this one, Bob Dole really doesn't have a leg to stand on.
Well, but the Democrats, of course, are in some doo-doo here, too, Amy, because, you know, we have this election year conversion of Al Gore to an anti-tobacco militant, although until recently he received profits from a tobacco farm in Tennessee, and that extremely maudlin speech that he gave about the death of his sister at the Democratic convention, which many people found to be objectionably opportunist. Both parties have taken tobacco money for years, but you have to realize the Democrats are taking some hits for the president's tobacco stand, and it may, in fact, impact their ability to control Congress. There are seats in play in North Carolina and Kentucky that the Democrats might have a much better chance at if they hadn't taken this tobacco stand. But, of course, in other parts of the country, Clinton's seemingly strong anti-tobacco stand will help him.
It's true, Larry, on the issue of Democrats and tobacco. I know well from trying to get into those tobacco parties at both the Republican and the Democratic conventions, I was thrown out equally by the Philip Morris people and the delegations of Democrats and Republicans who are being feted by the tobacco companies. And of course, while Clinton says he's gone after tobacco and he has made a lot of noise about it, ultimately they have not come up with an agreement on the issue of nicotine as a drug, and there isn't any regulation there at this point. Well, we're now going to turn to an issue that we have not heard any debate on in the last what they call debates, and that is the issue of jobs in this country and jobs leaving this country, basically because Bob Dole and President Clinton agree. Here's the question.
Hi, my name's Bridget Giannotti, and I'm a wife and mother of two sons from Carlsbad. And my question for you, Senator Dole, is, as the wife of a San Diego business owner, I see one of our biggest problems in the U.S. does not manufacture enough of our own products. How would you help this problem out?
Well, right, we've lost 357,000 manufacturing jobs. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics said today that they made a mistake. It's probably going to be a much, much higher figure. So we're talking about all these new jobs. We better wait and see what the results are. We're going to do that with a more aggressive trade policy. We're going to do that with an economic package. We're going to do that with regulatory reform. You know, regulations cost the average family, right here, Democrat or Republican, about $7,000 a year. $7,000, that's like a tax. Put a lot of people out of business. I met a lady in Colorado Springs about 7 weeks ago now. She had a small business with 63 employees. She finally gave it up. Why? Because of paperwork and regulation. Congress passed a Paperwork Reduction Act. The president exempts the IRS, which creates three-fourths of paperwork. We're going to have regulatory, we're going to have litigation reform. You know, I fell off a platform out in California, Chico, a while back. Before I hit the ground, my cell phone rang, and this trial lawyer says, I think we got a case here. You know, we got to stop some of these frivolous lawsuits. They're putting people out of business, men and women. Get the economy going. Cut the capital gains rate. Create more jobs.
Well, basically, President Clinton did not say much different, and they did not even mention the words NAFTA and GATT, possibly because they understand there is a lot of hostility around these issues in this country, and this is probably one of the reasons that Ross Perot and Ralph Nader are not included in the debates. One clearly distinguishing feature between these other two candidates, and that is they are fiercely anti-NAFTA and GATT.
Right. But you noticed, Amy, that Bob Dole twice during the debate last night, as he would do as somebody who's so far behind, called for more debates. And he all of a sudden is a convert to having other candidates come into the debates with him and Bill Clinton. One can only imagine what might have happened in these debates had Ralph Nader and Ross Perot and Harry Brown and others been present to take apart some of these self-serving and obvious statements from a different point of view. And it really is tragic. Once again, that we are really not having, and that's why you're calling them so-called debates, we're not having real discussions of issues in these debates because of the very, very strict limitation on who gets to speak and how they get to speak.
Well, let's talk about affirmative action, one of the questions asked by one of the people in the town hall meeting last night.
My name is Tressie Sanders, and my question is, do you feel that America has grown enough and has educated itself enough to totally cut out affirmative action?
No, ma'am, I don't. I am against quotas. I'm against giving anybody any kind of preference for something they're not qualified for. But because I still believe that there is some discrimination and that not everybody has an opportunity to prove they're qualified, I favor the right kind of affirmative action. I've done more to eliminate programs and to rate affirmative action programs I didn't think were fair and to tighten others up than my predecessors have since affirmative action's been around. But I have also worked hard to give people a chance to prove that they are qualified. Let me just give you some examples. We've doubled the number of loans from the Small Business Administration, tripled the number of loans to women business people. No one unqualified. Everybody had to meet the standards. We've opened 260,000 new jobs in the military to women since I've been president. But the Joint Chiefs say we're stronger and more confident and solid than ever. And let me give you another example of what I mean. For me, affirmative action is making that extra effort. It's sort of like what Senator Dole did when he sponsored the Americans with Disabilities Act and said to certain stores, okay, you've got to make it accessible to people in wheelchairs. We weren't guaranteeing anybody anything except the chance to prove they were qualified, the chance to prove that they could do it. And that's why I must say I agree with General Colin Powell that we're not there yet. We ought to keep making those extra effort affirmative action programs the law and the policy of the land.
And there you have it. Dole followed up by saying he was for CCRI, the California Civil Rights, what many call Civil Wrongs Initiative. I thought it was interesting that Clinton used a very clever debating tactic here. He talked about the Americans with Disabilities Act, and, of course, that is something that Dole is proud of touting. And he mentioned, of course, Colin Powell. So when he discusses an issue that he's a little nervous about, that he's afraid he'll be labeled with the big L word, liberal, he brings in the things that most people identify with Dole.
And it was also interesting, Amy, that Dole did not use the L word very much last night, very few times compared to the first debate, having abandoned that tactic. But in his response to what Clinton just said, Dole said that he had supported affirmative action for some time, but concluded that nobody benefited except a small group. Well, the small...
Of rich people.
A small group of rich people benefited from affirmative action. I don't know where he got any facts to back that up. But
maybe he was thinking about corporate welfare and who gets money and favoritism in this country.
The sum time that he supported affirmative action included basically his entire political life until this year when he started to run for president. So this is an election year conversion. His very, very late jumping on what he thinks is a winning issue, the California Civil Rights Initiative in California, is having his supporters out here jumping up and down and tearing out their hair because basically they believe it's too little too late. And it's not clear that that initiative is going to win or win by very much anyway.
And as we said last night, while President Clinton said he opposes CCRI, he has not actually put much muscle or money into the fight against CCRI in California. Well, on the issue of a discrimination, another issue is brought up, and that's discrimination against gay men and lesbians.
I'm Bob Goldfarb. I'm a travel agent. And can you please explain your policy on the Employment Non-Discrimination Act that would have prohibited discrimination, would have prohibited people from being fired from their jobs simply for being gay or lesbian?
I'm for it. That's my policy. I'm for it. I believe that any law-abiding, tax-paying citizen who shows up in the morning and doesn't break the law and doesn't interfere with his or her neighbors ought to have the ability to work in our country and shouldn't be subject to unfair discrimination. So I'm for it.
Senator Dole?
Well, I'm opposed to discrimination in any form, but I don't favor creating special rights for any group. That would be my answer to this question. And I'm, you know, there'd be special rights for different groups in America, but I'm totally opposed to discrimination. Don't have any policy against hiring anyone, whether it's lifestyle or whatever. We don't have any policy that kind. Never have had in my office or will we have in the future. But as far as special rights, I'm opposed to same-sex marriages, which the president signed well after midnight one morning, in the dark of night, he opposed it. But I'll get back to the economic package because, again, I think...
And it is important to note here, as he talked about President Clinton in that late-night signing of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, that President Clinton, it has been announced that they have pulled their ads from the Christian radio stations that they have been running that say, that tout that they are for the Defense of Marriage Act. I guess there was a very angry gay and lesbian constituency out there that forced Clinton to do that. There were actually two questions on the issue, Larry.
Right. Yes, a minister from the Metropolitan Community Churches in San Diego brought up the issue later on, which proved to me, by the way, that the questioning was random in the audience. But on that point, Amy, the question of the Christian radio stations and the Christian churches, it's pretty clear right now that the Christian Coalition is not nearly as active for Bob Dole or not nearly as effective as they were in 1994. And he really missed a chance, I thought, last night when a conservative minister got up and asked him, what about restoring Christian values to this country? He went off again into his economic plan. It's clear that he is not the person that Ralph Reed and Pat Robertson wished he would be.
Well, you know, Larry, studies show or polls show that 1 out of 10 people in this country is gay or lesbian. There were 20 questions last night, so it's probably appropriate that there were 2 questions on the issue of ENDA and DOMA, the End of Discrimination Act Against Gays and Lesbians. Well, thanks very much, Larry, for being with us for that deconstruction. I will point out that the issue of Indonesia was raised again last night, and there are front-page stories on the front page of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal on the issue of President Clinton manipulating trade and human rights decisions in return for campaign contributions from 2 wealthy Indonesian families closely connected to the Suharto regime. Larry, I know you're coming up with your interview with Tom Hayden talking about his new book, so we're going to be going to that in just a minute. Folks, you're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. We're now going to turn to Larry's interview, Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent, with Tom Hayden, author and legislator. His new book is called The Lost Gospel of the Earth, A Call for Renewing Nature, Spirit, and Politics.
Tom Hayden, we don't have very many author legislators in this country, unlike some other countries around the world. You hold probably the record in the California legislature for writing books. You may hold some other records as well. This is your 6th or 7th book. Why at this point a book about ecology, the environment, and spirituality when your previous books have been what one might call more traditionalist political approaches?
Well, actually, in 1979, when I was in the anti-nuclear power movement, I wrote a book called The Love of Possession is a Disease with Them, which is a quote from Sitting Bull, I believe. And it was when I was in the throes of a really wrenching but useful discovery. I had just read Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, which kind of broke the silence about the Indian story. And it clarified for me in a spiritual way, but also intellectually, that the Vietnam War was a continuation of the war against the Indians. And it led me into Native spirituality, and then it led me into Ireland, and it led me into the American Transcendentalists like Thoreau. So I've been there ever since and have been... I wrote a book called The American Future, which is a political book, but it was about romantic transcendentalism and environmentalists and the need to restore that message. I've always had this, you know, anxiety and quest for meaning and what's it all about, and it accompanies me in my day-to-day work. So it kind of, I do my work and I cope with my questions and frustrations with that part of my personality that leads me to search and to write. And I'm not really saying that once I've written it down, I feel better. But there is a tonic therapy going on here as I try to make sense of my daily life, and I find it in deeper relationships with people and deeper relationships with ideas than I get out of politics. And I'd like to widen politics because I think our politics is too shrunken, too mechanical, too money-dominated, and causes burnout among too many good people. But the situation is there's a gap between spirituality and politics, and the answer is not to widen the gap by considering spirituality a retreat into some exploratory inside journey, while politics is where you, you know, fight over interests and power and so on. I think some blending is in order, and that's different than a church-state fusion. This is merely giving what Vaclav Havel would call giving some kind of metaphysical anchor to your political work.
In the California State Senate, you chair the Natural Resources and Wildlife Committee, which at some point in this book you say here you'd really like to change the name of it to the Nature Committee, but you're afraid they'd ride you out of Sacramento on a rail if you even tried.
Right, because natural resources gives it all away. Once you think the Earth is a resource, the Earth is in trouble. How would you like to think of yourself as a resource? It's a problem, but it kind of explains the nature of the whole problem.
But what happens to you, speak a little to our listeners around the country, as a veteran legislator now who served how many terms in the Assembly?
I've been 10 years in the Assembly, right, and going on my fourth and fifth year in the state Senate.
Your final term. Because
so I will out. Have given 18 years of my goddamn life. to politics.
It's the Irish in you that just came out a little bit, Tom. We may talk about that in a minute. The Natural Resources and Wildlife Committee, chairing it or even being a legislator in Sacramento, the problem to me is, as somebody who's also given 30 or 40 years of his goddamn life to the same causes basically that you have, is that trying to communicate to people who are, as you said before, blocked on a certain level about the nature of the earth, or the nature of equality, or the nature of social justice, or whatever, can be, as the kids say, heck of frustrating. And how do you play through this in the state Senate, in the California State Senate, as somebody who now has what should be a powerful position as chair of the, what is euphemistically called the Natural Resources and Wildlife Committee?
Well, I do have a powerful position for blocking bad things from happening, at least. The frustration is never being able to get good things to happen.
Can you save the Headwaters Forest?
Well, I'm more like a watchdog. I notice with great interest that the Headwaters Forest resolution, whatever it is, or compromise, has to be approved by the legislature, and that means my committee. And I've been disappointed with the buy-off of this buccaneer Charles Hurwitz, and I'm not inclined to support that kind of outcome without extensive hearings. But in the years that I've been in the legislature, I've been satisfied to be a watchdog. One of the things that I've noticed is that in the debates about the environment, until quite recently, there's been no clergy present. So in writing this book, I've tried to encourage that, and we've got a network formed called Clergy for All Creation. And on a national level, Paul Gorman, Rabbi Daniel Swartz, people you know, have been working for a group called the National Partnership on Religion and the Environment that is actually trying to reach out to congregations and divinity schools and so on to bring religion into the debate, just as Dr. King tried to bring the clergy in. Now, when I look back in my old age here on the civil rights movement, I always see images of the cross and clergy and black churches I was in as if they were there leading all the time. But when you read King's 1963 letter from a Birmingham jail, what's it about?
He's trying to get the other clergy involved.
He's saying that clergy are apathetic, they're right on the fence, they're complaining about not wanting to offend their congregants, their fundraising, their respectability. And he's forced to argue from a theological point of view that segregation is a sin because we're all God's children. So he's at point one, and he's in jail. So it took some struggle to bring some religious attention. And I think there's some signs of this happening with the environment now and in Latin America. And this book isn't all, I think, but it's an attempt to to elevate the environmental debate to a spiritual level, and practically to get the clergy engaged rather than neutral.
Cynics would say, and I imagine you'll run across a few of those, perhaps on other networks than Pacifica, that, well, now Tom Hayden sees the way the winds are blowing in the United States, and so he's playing the religion card. He sees that...
playing the religion card?
Yeah, he sees
How about
that,
Rush Limbaugh? I mean, these guys are proclaiming from the radio. That's partly what got me animated. They're arguing that you can eliminate species because God said it was okay. This is ridiculous. I mean, there's a thread of evidence you could use from the Bible. But Pat Robertson, Dominion Theology, this stuff is really dangerous. And I think what's going on is people engaged in rampant destruction, or people who view both people and animals as disposable if they're in the way of profit, have need of some high-level religious justification to salvage their conscience. And so they've twisted a slightly plausible interpretation of Genesis into a wholesale justification for their behavior that doesn't exist. It has to be answered on those terms, though.
Yes, and that's what I meant by playing the religion card. I'm putting it in.
They're playing the religion card.
Yes, they are, and as I said, cynics would say, well, now Tom Hayden has to sit down at the table and has to play on their terms because they now control the nature of the debate. The Ralph Reeds, the Pat Robertsons, the Rush Limbaughs, if you will, have made religion into an element of politics, really would like religion in many ways to take over our politics, and therefore we're playing on their field. The vulgar Marxists among us would say, let all that slide. Let's just go at it from an economic point of view. Let's go at it from a jobs point of view. Let's go at it from a communitarian point of view. We don't need all this spiritual stuff. How do you respond to them?
Spirituality is not something that you can impose if people are rejected for whatever reasons. But I think that the religious right does have to be answered, and I think it's dialectical. In other words, their noise on this has to wake people up to counter them. On the issue of dealing with the environment, jobs, and the economy without religion or without spirituality, it's not clear to me that the secular approach has been altogether successful. So a little...
No, it's quite clear to you on the contrary
a little tolerance is necessary here. I mean, I think the economy should not be mechanistically detached from spirituality, that human beings are not cogs in an economic machine. They're human beings. The natural world is not a storehouse of things for us to destroy and turn into products. If we honored human beings and nature as not disposable but having inherent value, you wouldn't have economics that were based on throwing people out, downsizing, greed, and all the rest of it. So I don't think you want spirituality to displace politics or economics. That's the retreat problem. You see people looking for spirituality to heal burnout, and they think that they can heal burnout by getting away. But in my view, there's no away out there.
Like throwing something away. There's no place to throw it.
the problem, a friend of mine said it's like the koan or the riddle in Zen Buddhism, where you're given an impossible question and you have to concentrate on it. You go through endless frustration trying to answer it, and then you discover that the answer is in you, and there really is no answer, and the barrier between you and the problem dissolves. If the barrier between us and the environment that we think is outside of us were to dissolve, and you were to feel a harmony, the politics and economics would be easier to constitute.
You have lived and worked in and around Los Angeles for a couple of decades now, at least. You represented a Los Angeles constituency in the California State Assembly and now in the California State Senate, ranging up the coast. And if my political antenna are not completely clogged with misinformation, I've heard that you have some interest in running for the mayoralty of the city of Los Angeles. The question of the environment in a big city context and of spirituality in a big city context is, I think, exceptionally daunting. Could you speak for a moment to our Pacifica listeners about the environmental concerns of Los Angeles, recognizing, of course, that a lot of people are listening to this program right now stuck in cars on big freeways
exactly.
in Los Angeles?
Well, I have an interest in running for mayor. I don't know if it's practical or feasible. So that aside, I still believe what I believe, and I hope that others will carry it out if I can't. The first point is that we've got a dualistic mentality to break down that says the environment's out there in the Sierras, and this is the city. The other way to look at it and turn it around is to say that the city is where the environment has been the most conquered and the most damaged. It's not an accident, for instance, that the area with the highest rate of poverty in Los Angeles is the zip code that has the highest rate of air pollution. That would be in South Central. Poverty and pollution intersect in the inner city. Cities are supposed to be about the quality of life. People are attracted to Los Angeles, they say, because of the weather.
When they can see it.
We can't have nice weather, exactly. You can't have nice weather if you build a city that's some kind of cancerous growth center. Growth is healthy, say, between the age of 1 and 21. At a certain point, it becomes problematic. If you're still growing at our age, you got tumors, and Los Angeles has tumors aplenty. If we're going to develop a new American city that could be a model for the world, it would have to treat the environment as a primary issue in the forefront rather than something you clean up after you build your buildings and lay out your streets and freeways. That would mean electric cars. That would mean rivers instead of a drainage ditch in the middle of Los Angeles. That would mean more park space, more mountain space. It would mean radical steps to gain efficiency, to end the dumping into canyons. I live on a canyon that Sullivan Canyon, that L.A. County defines not as a canyon, not as a great ecosystem, but it's on the list of sanitation facilities. It's to be filled with garbage at some point. Our garbage. I think there's one other level of this, and that is the spiritual. The spiritual cannot be achieved just by building a cathedral in downtown Los Angeles. Los Angeles.
Some would say it's defeated by building a cathedral.
Exactly. I don't know what it is, but Los Angeles does not invoke or stimulate a spiritual compassion or a sense of spiritual being. What does it invoke? What's it about? It's about entertainment and greed. So it invokes fear, envy, loathing, ambition, hostility, corruption, lust. Those are the kind of emotions that are evoked when greed has become the standard of excellence.
And yet there are times...
And so it's a city more of the fallen than a city of the angels.
But yet there are times, and I experience these sometimes on the days when it's clear and you can see the San Gabriel Mountains and the winds are blowing in the right direction and somehow nature has managed to defeat the automobile for one half a day. When you can see why people originally came to Los Angeles,
right. Well,
there's a softness to the air. The trees seem to be growing nicely.
Well, same in the Bay Area. There were grizzlies here right on the waterfront. And the lost gospel can't be recovered without reviving what the indigenous lifestyle was. And I know people are going to say, well, you can't go primitive on us. But I don't mean that. I just mean that the original environment of Los Angeles and of California evoked spectacular visions and spectacular imagination that is diminished and lost if everybody is jammed on the freeways at 13 miles an hour polluting their lungs. That's what's going on. I'll give you one story from the Chumash, who were a major tribe in Southern California. Compare this to the Garden of Eden story where Adam and Eve are expelled and nature is their antagonist, and if they work by the sweat of their brow and all that. In the Chumash story, the original people came from the islands off Southern California, which are kind of like a Garden of Eden, and they crossed to what's now California on a rainbow bridge that was made for them by a goddess named Hutash, which is a goddess of the earth. And if they fell off the Rainbow Bridge on their way here to California, they became dolphins. So the human was kin to the dolphin, and the trip to human society was over a rainbow. It wasn't an experience of expulsion and guilt. It was an original blessing that they experienced, in Matt Fox's words, rather than an original sin. Who's to say who's right, but what, or what the facts are, but what you believe and carry with you is a subconscious vision that will dictate a lot of your behavior. And we need to recover those stories and incorporate them in a broader sense of the continental dream.
And, of course, the story you just told here on Pacifica is one of the stories that's in your book, The Lost Gospel of the Earth, which retraces many of the Indian stories and legends and, of course, the sad and tragic genocidal behavior of those who eliminated largely the Native Americans from this continent. Tom Hayden, as we conclude this segment, I wonder if I could ask you to read this one paragraph from your book, The Lost Gospel of the Earth. Tom Hayden's new book, published by Sierra Club Books.
We assume we can mold and engineer the land, and when we zone ourselves in harm's way, we blame nature for the toll of floods, fires, and earthquakes. We are the only species unable to employ ourselves fully. Everything else in nature has a function. 50,000 Americans die in car accidents every year, and many thousands more from the tobacco, alcohol, and drugs that we take to steady our nerves. All these disorders of the modern world arise from our striving against nature, which stems from the arrogant false consciousness of being lords of the universe. The time has come to transform the hostile dream of conquest into the larger sacred dream of kinship that nature offers.
California State Senator Tom Hayden, from his new book just released, The Lost Gospel of the Earth, Reclaiming the Ecological Wisdom of Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, and Native Traditions for the Next Century, published by Sierra Club Books. And you're listening to Democracy Now! On Pacifica Radio. I'm Larry Bensky.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky, Pacifica's National Affairs Correspondent. And we now go back to the second part of Larry's interview with California State Senator Tom Hayden. His latest book is The Lost Gospel of the Earth, A Call for Renewing Nature, Spirit, and Politics.
Tom Hayden, I was wondering if you think it's valuable for people to get together and work on environmental projects. Does that necessarily rekindle perhaps in them the kind of spirituality you're looking at? And I'm thinking especially of something that's going on in your home region now. People are talking about taking away the horrific concrete barriers from the Los Angeles River and restoring it to something like an ecosystem rather than a sewer, which it now looks like. It's always been to me one of the images that sticks in my mind when I go to Los Angeles, because it's right near KPFK and I walk past it all the time. This wonderful, charged, natural force that has been put into a prison so it can run to the sea. And there's a movement down there, as you know, to take those concrete barriers away and make this into a real river again.
I'm part of that movement. I support it very much. It's making some small headway, but special interests, construction interests prevail. They make the contributions to the local government. It's terrible. And the taxpayers pick up a bill, which I think is $400 or $500 million and rising, simply to build higher cement walls to channel the force of this water, this runoff, even in a more incredible speed towards Long Beach, where it just blows out. Ask people in Long Beach how they feel about the end result of this. I think that you need to siphon that water off, make it a natural river to the extent possible, have holding ponds, have parks so that the groundwater is absorbed, is reclaimed. But the powers that be seem to think an underground subway at $300 million a mile for the contractors is what a great city is all about. I think it's a laughingstock. Great cities, including the Bay Area, including Dublin, including London, including Paris, happen to have rivers running through them. But few great cities have spent so much money of the taxpayers to crush, stop, and channel up the natural endowment that a river is. So that, it really tells something about the mentality in Los Angeles.
It definitely does, and it always, as I said, it seemed to me a metaphor when I see that that river channeled into concrete. But I'm wondering about something else you mention in your book about how people have lost the ability to behave in spiritually appropriate ways, if you will, because many of us no longer do anything physical that has anything to do with nature. We don't raise our own food. We don't even, in many cases, go for hikes. We certainly don't till the earth, plow the soil, etc. We are engaged in pursuits that involve machines all the time or even captured by machines.
Well, that's true for many of us. It's not to say that people who do backbreaking labor shouldn't be liberated by machines, but what we do with our time is, if it's not cell phones, it's television. The idea of a vacation is reduced to going and looking at something as if it's through a window, you know, maybe catch a grizzly bear at a distance, see him eat a salmon.
What's this new theme thing in Los Angeles? I hadn't experienced that. Oh, you heard about the City Walk.
City Walk, yeah, you bring in the foreign tourists and you put them in an artificial city of Los Angeles where crime can be really minimized because you're in a controlled environment. There's a little Jewish place, there's a little Asian place, there's an Italian place, there's actually Santa Monica Bay recreated kind of like electronically...
I can't believe it. I
gotta see this. Electronically charged waves that go and knock against a wall and fall back so that you get a sense of the ocean without having to go to it. It's a winner for tourists.
Because they don't actually have to go and see the real city. They go inside
park. Recreate the urban environment in a way that's cosmopolitan, multi-ethnic, safe, and artificial. On the other hand, here, what's positive to me or really fascinating to me is, I'm one of these people that rushes around and is caught up in technology, but I have noticed that I have a desperate need occasionally to work on the lawn. I took out my lawn. I put in a lot of drought-resistant plants, and people around me. I think gardening is probably the number one hobby of Americans. Now, is this an ancient longing from the Garden of Eden? I don't know what it is, but it's more than just a residual need. It seems to be a growing need. And going on vacation, spending your whole year making just enough money to get away from what you do for a living to go somewhere and see something inspiring, those are, I think, very strong pieces of evidence for this need for a larger engagement with the natural world that has been reduced to and channeled into a very shrunken concept of brief vacations as if the rest of life is what it's really all about, and you just get these occasional glimpses. So I do think the personal here is important, and I didn't used to. I mean, I think the people who read and know everything that's going on in Sunset Magazine are an important group of people, and they don't know their importance because it's been reduced. The definition has been reduced to, well, it's a hobby. You garden. It's a hobby. But what's really going on is therapy, is redemption, is getting rid of stress, is regenerating life in the soil. What they're doing are things that are so important to their own lives and to the earth that it should be far expanded.
Is any of that possible on a consistent basis for a significant segment of the population under the capitalist system? Let me bring you back to the Tom Hayden I once knew and had long discussions with. You've written this book, The Lost Gospel of the Earth. I read it, and I think this is wonderful. I know a lot of people listening to Pacifica will read it and say, this is really something I can relate to, and I've been thinking some of these same thoughts. And yet I say to myself, well, if Tom Hayden runs for mayor of Los Angeles, is he going to be saying to people who are desperate about the education of their children, desperate about the security situation in their neighborhoods, desperate about the jobs that they may or may not have and their ability to meet their bills? Or is Tom Hayden going to be then painted into a corner by his inevitable opponents as another Governor Moonbeam? Are we talking about elitist stuff here, or are we talking about something that you think can be translated into a mass political message?
Well, Governor Moonbeam was right. Let me just say that flat out. And his critics were wrong.
He'll be happy to hear you say that. He's on Pacifica every single day.
best governor we've had on all these issues, and that's why he was stereotyped and dismissed. The same thing happened to St. Francis. Anybody like that is immediately marginalized.
He'll be pleased with that comparison.
By the lords of the universe who want to keep control of the state. What I would say to the president or the governor is from Los Angeles or from the inner cities that we need a turn toward peace. We need a gang truce worked out. We need to put all these young men into remedial education, training, and jobs. And the best thing for them and for the cities would be a massive civilian conservation corps, restoring the environment of the inner city, restoring the environment of California. So I don't see these as either-ors. As to capitalism, I'm of a mixed feeling. In the whole environmental movement, you have some people who think, like Paul Hawken in his really brilliant book, Ecology and Commerce, that a different kind of independent capitalism, not subsidized, would make the right choices. And there are a lot of private firms that do important environmental services, so they should be honored. How far can that go is almost a theological issue in itself. I'd say let it go as far as it can and put me down as a skeptic to the extent that capitalism depends on the artificial stimulation of envy, demand, buy, more consumption.
The bottom line being profit. The bottom line is not the good of
humanity. Capitalism would need to incorporate into its understanding of itself the cost of environmental damage, the cost of human health. It would have to have, therefore, a redefinition of profit, and it would have to make things that last rather than things that are supposed to be immediately disposable. On the other hand, so would socialism. On the other hand, so would industrialism. I mean, anything that is based on the artificially reducing the cost to itself of grabbing environmental resources and turning them into things for sale is at odds with the environment. The task is to kind of relocate the economy in the environment, rather than thinking the environment's a shed you go to outside the economy to pick up more stuff you need.
Was there a personal incident or a personal moment that you can think of that was transformative for you? Or were you always the same person? I've known you at two periods of your life. I knew you at Newark a little bit when you were living in the inner city and running something called the Newark Community Union Project, NCUP. And then, of course, I knew you a lot better when you were here in Berkeley in the late 60s and early 70s. Were you the same guy then, but just didn't tell us, or did something happen along the way? Was there a blinding flash of light, or is this a process?
No. Well, you have those moments where the whole universe seems in order. Everybody does. I mean, you can have that on a camping trip, I suppose. But no transformative moment. Simply 30 years of trying to work for justice or work on issues from an underdog perspective weighs very heavily. And I don't find that secular explanations or political science alone are enough to get me through. And I'm the kind of stubborn guy who, you know, I won't back down. I won't walk away. And And therefore, the sustaining strength has to be spirituality and relationships with people, with friends that are nourishing.
Tom Hayden, I found your book, The Lost Gospel of the Earth, to be, among other things, very well written and very poetically conceived in many places. I wondered if we could conclude perhaps by your reading a passage here which deals again with this artificial megacity that has been built up as a theme park, which I think this one paragraph kind of sums up a lot of what you're talking about.
You're very kind. The entertainment-based megacity, I'm talking about Los Angeles here, is total, promoting a message that there is no alternative, that its nature is the nature of the modern world. The past is dimmed, retained in museum collections and archives. The loss of the past is the loss of the dreams and ideals of the original place. We live in a stressed and polluted urban universe, not a city of angels, not in the universe itself, as native people always did. We are in danger of losing the sense that nature is connected with the meaning of life. This is a loss of the spiritual resource that could be the basis for a challenge to the modern consecration of development without end. That resource is the lost gospel of the native people who lived here for thousands of years before the conquest that became California.
California State Senator Tom Hayden. There is, of course, much more in his book, and I understand that he's going to be writing another tome about his Irish roots and the spirituality involved there, the Native American element that we just heard touched on, Buddhism and its potential implications for a restoration of nature, the educational system, and all the things we don't hear. But in order to find that out, you're going to have to read it. The Lost Gospel of the Earth by Tom Hayden. Reclaiming the Ecological Wisdom of Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, and Native Traditions for the Next Century, published by Sierra Cub Books. Thanks for joining us on Pacifica's Democracy Now!, Tom Hayden.
Thanks, Larry.
I'm Larry Bensky in Berkeley, California.
Rainforest, mist and mystery, teeming green. Green brain facing the bottom. Climate Control Center for the World. Ancient cord coexistence hacked by parasitic greedhead scam. From Sarawak to Amazonas, Costa Rica to mangy BC hills, cortege rhythm of falling timber. What kind of currency grows in these new deserts, these brand new floodplains? Wildlife at a rate of a species every single day. Take out people who've lived with this for 100,000 years. Inject a billion burgers worth of beef.
Democracy Now! Has been produced and engineered by Julie Drizin. Production help from Mark Beavis. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Gravity, light, ancient refuse of stars, speak of a drowning. But this is something other. Busy monster eats dark holes in the spirit world.